Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Music, Money, and Life podcast. This podcast, as always, is brought to you by howtolicenseyourmusic.com. If you're interested in learning how to make money licensing your music into television shows, video games, commercials, advertisements, and more, visit howtolicenseyourmusic.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Music, Money, and Life. Today, I'm speaking with Portia Sabin from the label Kill Rock Stars. And Portia, I thought what we would do is if you could start by telling us what you do at Kill Rock Stars on the website, on the Kill Rock Stars website. Your title is listed as Label Dude. What exactly does a label dude at KRS do?
Well, I think it's also important to mention that some of the other titles at Kill Rock Stars are like bad cop.
Yeah.
That's one of our job descriptions.
Yeah, you're not the only one.
So, yeah, I'm not the only one. I settled on that as a job description because it was the most encompassing. And basically, I own the record label. The label was started 26 years ago in Olympia, Washington by Slim Moon, and I took over the label 11 years ago, and I own it, and I'm the president, and I do the A&R at the label, which means I find bands and now comedians, because we've moved into doing comedians.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I... you know, do all the contract stuff. I do all the accounting. We pay royalties to our artists 4 times a year, and I do all that by hand.
Well,
because that's a very important part of our business. You know, I routinely meet artists who say that they've never received a royalty check from their record label, and I always feel like that's a tragedy. You should at least be getting a statement if you're not getting a check. You should know where you're at with your money, because, you know, it's your life and your income, your job. And I, you know, I'm the boss, basically. You know, I that's what I could have put on my,
yeah.
But it seemed a little aggro to just be like boss. So
yeah.
I went for Label Dude.
I like Label Dude. That's a lot more fun. That's much more creative. So, well, I'm really excited to talk to you. This is going to be fun. I have for the last 9 years now run a website called howtolicenseyourmusic.com, and my podcast, for the most part, I tend to focus on licensing and publishing and music supervision, things related to licensing. So you're actually the first person I've had on from a bona fide, like, real record label. So I was really interested to bring you on, Portia, to sort of have a conversation about the music business in 2017, how it's obviously changed a lot over the last couple decades. And I wanted to get your perspective about what running a record label is like in the current climate we find ourselves in. Can you talk a little bit about sort of where we're at in terms of the overall business and record sales and what exactly sort of the function and role of a record label is in 2017?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is what I'm obsessed with and what I think about all the time because it's my job. I started running Kill Rock Stars in 2006. I took over at the end of 2006, which literally meant that I have presided over a record label through the like crash of the physical music sales industry era. You know, I came in right at the tail end of when we were making all our money on physical sales, and right at the beginning of, well, first of all, the recession, which was charming, for everybody. And then this rise in, you know, streaming music. I sort of have lived through the whole, all of the major changes in the last 10 years. And I would say my takeaway for 2017 is that we're in a more interesting time today than I would have ever been able to predict 10 years ago, because I think where we've gone to, I think what happened with the internet was the internet promised this vista of monstrous numbers of people, right? Like it was like, now you're going to be able to get your music in front of millions and billions of people. Like everybody is now going to be able to see your, you know, hear your music.
Right.
And what really has actually happened is that we have developed a marketplace in which people have discovered that super serving the super fan is how we're making a living. It is not about getting your music in front of the greatest number of people. It's about finding the people who love your music and creating products that are just for them. And their price points can be higher because people are willing to pay more for something that's nice, which is part of the reason that we're seeing, you know, the sustained growth in vinyl, because, you know, a super fan is going to buy your three record box set that's really well done and comes with a 26-page full color booklet and also a baseball cap and also, you know, the keys to your house or whatever you've decided to package with it. And they're going to buy that at a higher price point than we used to see when it was more of a broad marketplace, right? You know, more people buying lower priced items. And I really find that that is fascinating. Like I find, and across the board, that's what I'm seeing. I, in fact, also have a podcast. It's about the music business and it's called The Future of What. And that, the episode that we are releasing this week is about people who have started subscription services, because subscription services in my mind are sort of the physical manifestation of the era that we're in. You know, it's super serving the super fan. It's providing X number of people, which is not a big number of people, you know, 2,500 people or however many. And that's, you know, 2,500 people in the light of eternity is not a lot of people.
Right.
But those 2,500 people are subscribed and to your, let's say, label subscription service, and they're purchasing everything. They're getting every single thing that you put out in a month, and they're getting special prizes, and they're getting, you know, ticket opportunities, and they're getting and, right?
Mm.
So that's actually the model that has become the most prevalent and the most successful, I would say, in 2017.
Interesting. And would you say that this sort of serving the superfan idea, was this always sort of a viable option? Was it always on the table and just record labels overlooked it because they were able to serve such a broad market? Like, could you have done this sort of model in 1999 or 2006, or is it, I mean, certainly there are probably just as many people that love and appreciate music as ever, but it just doesn't seem like as many of them are buying music. So it sounds like what you're saying is there's still a select group of people that are really, really into certain artists, and they'll spend more than the typical fan.
Well, right, because you have to, you know, from a record label's perspective, like let's do it in very financial, clear financial terms. So when I took over the label in 2006, I was pretty much guaranteed there was like a baseline of sales, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say I could pretty much be sure that I would sell 2,000 copies of anything I put out.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, let's say that the price that I got from my distributor for each of those pieces, which would be CDs at the time, you know, because vinyl wasn't, you know, the thing, was, let's say, $7. So 7 times 2,000, I'm looking at $14,000, which means if I can keep my costs down, if I can spend less than $14,000 making the record,
yeah,
then I have an instant profit, and the band has an instant profit on that record. Now, you know, It even puts you in a position, let's say it costs $20,000 to make the record. Well, we only have to make up $6,000. And you can do that fairly quickly. I mean, one license, for example,
yeah,
would put you over the top and put you in the black. So it would be, in other words, that was the model that we were working with 10 years ago. And really very, very much overnight, it moved from I can be guaranteed to sell 2,000 copies of this CD to I'm not guaranteed to sell any copies of this CD because music has, you know, there was this whole thing about music is now free.
Yeah.
People are like, oh yeah, music's free. I just can go on the internet and get it for free. And it was very, that was a very terrifying moment because all of a sudden I'm like, well, what do I tell bands? How
yeah.
do I tell them that there's a bottom, like there's no way for me to tell them I'm guaranteed to make any money on this record at all. You know, we're not necessarily going to recoup our investment. Now, a record label like Kill Rockstars, an indie label like us, you know, we can do things really cheaply. We can make an excellent record for $14,000. That's not what you're looking at in the major world, right? You know, majors spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on everything that they do, and they have a totally different business model than we have, of course. But, you know, in the indie world, that was something that was viable. But to just completely pull the rug out from under us and say, nope, sorry, you know, you're guaranteed nothing, that really set everybody back on their heels pretty hard because now you have to be really careful about the bands that you sign because, you know, it pushed people to sign more known quantities rather than new bands.
Yeah.
Because a new band, you have no idea if you're going to sell one copy. At least if you put out a band that, you know, you've worked with before and you have their sales figures and you know that they're going to sell some copies, you know, that can help you be able to make a better decision. And you know, that's exactly what I found. And I feel like there was like a 3 or 4 year period there where everything was just really up in the air and you had no idea what was going to happen with anything that you put out.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you.
From when to when, like when would you say that this sort of shift, when did it kind of definitively start?
Definitely in 2009 with
yeah.
the recession.
Okay.
And then, you know, 2009 through like 2012 or 13, I would say, because I think Spotify came into the marketplace in 2011. And that was a disruptor because
yeah.
of the streaming, the very low streaming rates at the time, which is what everyone was really upset about. But it hadn't settled. You know, we hadn't seen it over time, so people didn't know. And now Spotify is a, you know, fabulous source of income, at least for a label like mine, because we have a lot of different kinds of artists. We have some, you know, really deep catalog, and we have some really big legacy artists. But across the board, Spotify has been good for all of our artists. You know, but that's something that we've seen in the last 5 years. Not, you know, that wasn't evident right away. So during those years, that was a tough moment for everybody to just be like, oh my God, what are we doing? How are we going to stay open? How are we going to keep putting out artists? And it was scary to feel like maybe we can't work with the kinds of young up-and-coming artists that we have always worked with and that we want to work with
yeah.
because we just don't know if we can make it worth their while. And now, you know, streaming has really solidified to a degree that's comfortable. However, you know, there's always something in the music industry that's around the corner. And, you know, it's been rumored all year that Spotify is going to do an IPO. And if they do, that could disrupt the marketplace again.
If they do an IPO, you think that would adversely affect the marketplace?
I wouldn't say necessarily adversely affect it. I'm just saying it will shake up the marketplace again because, you know, if for some reason Spotify goes away, that's going to leave a gaping hole in the marketplace. However, I know that, you know, the other big players are poised to jump into that hole. So it wouldn't be quite as disruptive as the advent of streaming itself, because now streaming is established and people are used to it.
Yeah.
You know, and if people had to change platforms, that's less disruptive than like introducing an entirely new format.
Yeah.
But it would shake things up to some extent because, you know, people are kind of getting used to Spotify right now. Like everyone's like, okay, I think I understand that this is how we do music. Like,
right.
Stream it.
And this is how many streams you need to create to produce X amount of income and so on. So one of the things that you mentioned, I mean, to me, this is very interesting because it seems like one of the sort of kind of, to me, sort of sad realities about the music business currently is that it's become harder and harder for labels to take chances on up-and-coming indie bands. You know, I think we can all sort of sense that music is becoming more homogenized and labels are less likely, like you said, to take a chance on an unknown artist. Can you speak to sort of like what's your take on up and coming indie bands and artists that are out there right now that are trying to break through? Should they look to labels like yours? Is that still sort of the path? Is that still what we should go after? Like, what do you think is the best sort of viable way for up and coming artists to break in?
Well, the funniest thing about the music industry is that it's just a constant source of contradictions, right? There's something going on over here and the opposite is going on over there. And so at the same time as I've been presiding over, you know, what I considered for several years there to be like a very frightening downward spiral of the music industry,
mm-hmm.
A whole ton of people were opening new record labels. Starting new record labels. And I spent a couple of years going, those people are crazy. Those people are out of their minds. That's completely insane. And now that those labels have been around for a few years and they're doing well, I'm looking at those labels and I'm going, wait a second. They have done well in this economy. They have found a way to succeed and to sign young, up-and-coming artists who are, you know, in many cases hotter, you know, become hotter and hotter. You know, than anything that, you know, we're putting out on the more venerable older labels like my own. And I'm thinking about like Don Giovanni Records and Joyful Noise. You know, there are some wonderful young record labels. Oh, Father Daughter Records, an amazing label. You know, these labels that have just sprung up in the last few years, and they're putting out very cutting edge, very exciting artists who, you know, maybe wouldn't have been noticed or you know, by an older label like mine, or we would feel like we couldn't take the chance on them. And they are taking the chances and they're doing great. So, you know, there's more hope in this scenario than, like, I would say around, I don't know, 2012 or something, I was pretty bummed.
Yeah.
I think I should get into like toilet paper manufacturing or something, like really just like something that people always need, you know, like, just
right.
Go somewhere else with this. But I've been feeling way more hopeful lately, and I think it's largely because I'm just, you know, there are some really fantastic bands out there, and there are some really fantastic labels that are working with them.
Yeah.
I would also say, you know, sort of also to your point, I think that bands, my advice for bands is you have to be really savvy about your business, and you have to understand your own position in sort of the world and the shape of things or the size of things, because there are artists, you know, also in the last 5 or 6 years, and probably a little bit longer, but definitely in the last few years with streaming, there are artists who are probably doing better as self-released artists than they would in a label. And, you know, I think in many cases, you have to have the right personality for that. You have to be willing to do a lot of the work yourself. You can't be lazy. You can't be one of those bands who's like, you know, oh, we're going home. Call us when we're famous. You have to be willing to put the work in. But, I mean, I have friends, artists who are on CD Baby who are just killing it, you know, CD Baby, or they release through their own websites, and they have booking agents, and they do tours. I just interviewed Joe Pug, who is an independent singer-songwriter, similar situation, and he's got a podcast, and he sells stuff through the website, and he's on tour, you know, many months of each year, and he's really found a way to make a living as an independent artist without a label, and I think that that's an exciting time, too. Now, there's sort of two sides to that story, which is, one, sometimes you can do the independent route because you're good at it and you're going to make more money at it because you're a really hard worker. And sometimes you have to go the independent route because you're actually not ready to be on a label.
Yeah.
You know, young bands have to be really they have to examine themselves and say, like, well, what are we doing here? What is this? Is this really, are we ready? Are we finished? Are we, you know, is this album what we're really going to sound like, you know, or are we still evolving our sound, you know? And that's why I think a lot of the technology is so great, like Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Like, anybody can put up their stuff on Bandcamp, and sell it. And you know, you're not like beholden. You can change your sound. You can get a different bass player. You can decide to have no bass at all. You know, you can do whatever you want while you sort of find yourself musically. Because that's the other thing is that, you know, that is one thing I would say across the board. You know, a bigger indie like mine is not going to get excited about a band if you send them your five songs that you've ever written. You know, like, well, these are the five songs we wrote. What do you think?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, you're you know? Looking for more.
I want to see evidence. Evidence of seriousness, you know. The last young band we signed had actually put out their own first two records on their own label, the band Summer Cannibals from Portland, and had gone on several different tours. And we're just way more, you know, clear about the business side and, you know, who they were and what they wanted than most young acts. And so that's something that's very appealing to a label is to get involved with people who know what they're doing. You know, because this is a job that has a lot of sort of sexiness to it and people get real excited about it. But the problem is a lot of being in a band is not a sexy job. It's a job.
Yeah, and, for sure.
And And when you get together with a label, basically someone like me is saying to you, I have so much faith in you that I'm willing to put my money behind you. And so you just don't want to do that lightly. You don't want to take somebody's money lightly. You don't want to enter into that kind of relationship if you're not really serious about it. And I think that's one of the hardest things for label owners and A&R people is to just be able to discern which bands are really serious, because every band will tell you that they want to go on tour who's never been on tour. But really, the ones who you have to look out for are the ones who've been on tour and say, yes, they will go back on tour.
Right. Who still want to do it.
Who still want to do it. Because touring is not easy. It is not for everybody.
For sure. And it's especially not easy on sort of an indie level. You know, if you're staying in cheap hotels or sleeping on friends' floors, that's, you know, maybe fun when you're in your 20s, but it's not a lifestyle everybody's drawn to. So can you sort of talk a little bit about, because you said a lot of interesting things, can you talk about sort of what you look for in artists that you sign? You're obviously looking, like you said, for a certain level of professionalism and a certain attitude. Is there sort of a set criteria that artists need to meet, or is it more of sort of a vibe that you pick up on, obviously in the music, but the personalities of the band members as well?
Yeah, it's definitely a vibe, and it's definitely a clicking thing. You know, we have to meet the band and get to know them a little bit and feel like we are on the same page and understand each other. I mean, I think that's critical, because you're going to have a working relationship with these people that hopefully lasts a long time. I mean, you know, we have so many artists on our roster that we're doing their, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh albums. So it's a long time that you're going to spend together. And so you obviously want to do that just like you do with friends, right? With people that you actually like and think are great. And you have to love the music. You have to, you know, I have to just get super excited about the music and feel proud to put something out. I mean, everything that is out on Kill Rock Stars that I put out, I feel proud of, you know, and that's my number one criteria. Like, I would never want to put a record out where I'm like, ooh, well, I said I would do it. You know, that's the worst. And it's not fair to the band, right? I mean, the band should be working with people who just adore them and think they're geniuses and love what they're producing. So, you know, that's the ideal for everybody to have that relationship.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, what I'm interested in is sort of where, like, you've mentioned things like Spotify, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast sort of more like subscription-based model. Like, where is the revenue these days in putting out albums? Is it a combination of all these different things? Like, how are you actually generating revenue?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a patchwork, right? It's a ton of income streams. It's, you know, mysteriously CDs still sell, which is really strange, but every album we do put out on CD with very, very few exceptions. that has to do though with the fact that we have a national and international distributor. So, you know, we're putting CDs into foreign markets as well, where CDs haven't quite died as much as they have in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just read an article by someone who said that the preponderance of CDs is probably due to the fact that more people are likely to listen to a CD in a car than
yeah.
they are to, you know, listen to it in any other venue. And that's kind of like, while we still have all these cars in America, you know, millions of cars with CD players, like it's
yeah.
still a very viable format. And so we, you know, we definitely see vinyl sales, CD sales. We'll make cassettes for certain releases. Those always sell out. You know, so you don't make a ton of money with cassettes. That's kind of more like a promotional item that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
But you do, you know, you sell what you make. And then, you know, just we always try to have fun with all of our releases. We try to have some pre-order bonus items that are fun for people. So we do try to tap into, you know, we don't actually have a subscription service, but sort of that model of like if you pre-order the record, you get all these fun things. And then those can be good sellers. You know, we have an online store, so we do, you know, whatever's in there, coffee mugs and T-shirts and that sort of stuff, and that's an income stream. And then, of course, there's, you know, licensing, which is your wheelhouse. You know, licensing mm-hmm. is still a viable income stream. It also feels to me like it's having a little bit of a recurrence and resurgence. There were a few really dark years in there where I think we had saturated the marketplace with, you know, indie bands and unsigned bands that were willing to do stuff for such low prices
yeah.
that it drove the whole industry down. I feel like those prices are rebounding a little bit better now. And I think people have put licensing in perspective where they are like, I would love to license a song, but I realize it's a lot like getting struck by lightning. It's not necessarily, it's certainly not guaranteed. You can't factor it into your budget when you create a budget, right?
Yeah.
You just have to be like, well, I hope somebody like, you know, this, some of these songs can be licensed. Because I think people have now understand that it's not simple, right? Like writing a song that can be licensed is not a formula that you can just sit and churn out. And also, I think people, you know, especially in this arena of independent music, you know, most of the musicians I know are more interested in writing music that reflects themselves. You know, they're writing songs that are important to them. They're not necessarily like, I just want to be a gun for hire who's going to write the perfect McDonald's, you know, song to be used in a McDonald's commercial or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, with the ascending arc or whatever the, you know, the licensing terminology is. So, you know, I feel like that's also an income stream, but it's not, you know, it's yet again not just the lion's share. And then there's streaming and downloads. You know, downloads are still in the marketplace. They're still, you know, significant. But streaming is massive. That's where the bulk of it is. And I'm trying to think what else we have. You know, we're a record label, so we have some licensing royalties too that come in from other, you know, from other labels that we've licensed music to or other territories or whatever.
Yeah.
So those are sort of the major income streams for a label.
Interesting. So would you say now in 2017 compared to like those dark years you said, like 2008 to 2012, has it rebounded to where it was pre-2008? Is it just a completely different sort of model and it's not really a fair comparison? Like, where do you see running a label sort of in the grand scheme of things compared to where it was before it got bad?
Well, if you're talking like dollars wise, like, are we at the same level? Are we making the same amount of money? Are we making, you know, like, where are we? I would say it's rebounded considerably. I wouldn't say it's as good as it was pre 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I think those were, you know, there was something that was very, I mean, a $7 sale for a CD it's hard to make that $7 in streaming plus, little thing.
Yeah.
That $7 was a very strong number for
Yeah.
the record industry.
Yeah. That you could do
So,
over and over and over.
exactly. So I wouldn't say it's been replicated, but I would definitely say, I mean, they say the statistics are that the music business has shrunk by 50% in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I think that's a fairly good benchmark. That doesn't necessarily mean that an individual label's royalties have shrunk by that much, or that a individual artist's income has shrunk by that much. But I definitely think that it's not quite where it was, and it's a little less. You're just dealing with a different kettle of fish, because, like I said, that $7 number was very strong. And now, if you would ask me, well, what are you making on a given release? I'd have to go and look at the streaming numbers, and it's like, well, we're talking about fractions of pennies, right? So you have to put all those together, and
Yeah.
you have to, it's just not solid the way it once was. It's not this very clear round number, like it once was. So it's just a different animal. But that said, the labels that have started up in the last 10 years certainly seem to be doing just fine. Now, it's also your business model. It's also how you make your money. Some labels are doing great because they also have a management company, or they also have a publishing company, or they, in some cases, like secretly, the Secretly Group, they have a distributor that they also own. So some indie labels are doing well by having a lot of different, their hands in a lot of different pies. Some are doing very strong subscription services, like Joyful Noise. That's a really good example of that. So indie labels are varied in their business models, and so people are doing well by switching it up and by thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like a dinosaur, because all I do is sell records. Like, I don't have a publishing company, and I don't have a distributor, and I don't, have a management company anymore, although I used to. So, being like the pure thing that we are, it's hard. It's definitely harder to make money just doing the one thing.
Yeah. But then again, I'm sure it gives you sort of a certain competitive edge in the sense that, like you said, a lot of labels have closed. A lot of places have gone out of business. The fact that you're still selling music, like I would imagine that's sort of a niche focus.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is definitely a niche focus. And also, I mean, we're lucky in that we have a 26-year reputation, right? So
Yeah.
people who have liked Kill Rock Stars stuff in the past are still pretty interested in what we're doing now. And I think that's also a part of the internet culture that's been really interesting, because, like I said at the beginning of the interview, everybody thought, oh, the internet's going to be this like huge level playing field where everybody gets to just, find music and discover things so simply. And really what happened was it just turned into this giant ocean of noise.
Right.
And the role of the record label, which has always been as a filter, right? Like a filter for what's out there, became even more important once the internet took hold, because it was truly a filter in a sea of noise. So you're like, oh crap, I don't even know where to start listening to stuff. Like, but
Yeah.
oh hey, I've liked Merge bands, or I've liked Sub Pop bands, or I've liked Kill Rock Stars bands. I'm gonna go there to their website and see what they just put out.
Yeah.
Like, it's been very helpful in that regard. Just for labels to have, that filter power.
Yeah, there's so much music out there. It's a bit overwhelming. I mean, there's almost, I forget who it was, but I was interviewing a music supervisor a couple of weeks ago, and I've kind of heard the same sentiment echoed in a few different ways, but he said there's too much music out there in a way. And it's sort of true. It's like the internet on one hand, anybody can sort of throw their hat in the ring, but the downside of that is everybody's throwing their hat in the ring, and there's just an enormous amount of music out there, and a lot of it isn't that great, right?
Well, right. I mean, then you just end up with a giant ring full of hats. And you
Yeah.
still are like, well, how do I know which hat is going to be the one that I'm going to like? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you find that hat? So yeah, filters are more important than ever. And I think that's what people have been doing for each other forever in the history of music, right? Is saying, oh, you got to hear this great band that I love, or making each other mixtapes. And, you know, one of the things that Spotify has done that's amazing and I truly, truly love is the playlisting.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's exactly what that is. It's just like I used to make mixtapes for my friends in the 80s. You know, it's like a way to say, hey, like, check this out. Here's something you might not have heard. And I love that. For me, that's a great discovery tool because it's really simple. It's like, oh,
yeah,
listen to all this great stuff
that
I wouldn't have otherwise pulled out.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like a digital mixtape.
Yeah, totally.
Do you ever, I have just a couple more questions for you, Portia, then I'm going to let you go. But do you, like, one thing that I don't fully understand, and maybe I'm missing something, but do you ever see sort of a time in which we return to sort of the model of you hear a song on the radio and then you go buy the CD? And I know we're not going to return to that literal model, but wouldn't there be a way for websites like Spotify to sort of incentivize actually buying music? Like, it just, I guess the point I'm trying to make is it seems like all these platforms like YouTube and like Spotify, they're all sort of doing the advertising revenue business model. But why couldn't, do you ever see a return to, like, you hear a free song on Spotify and you can play it three times, and then if you like it, you have to buy it? I don't quite understand why no one's tried that. Do you follow my question?
I do. I don't, you know, it's really hard to say it because that's getting into like a whole other realm of stuff that is outside my purview. You know,
yeah,
the music industry is a comparatively tiny industry, right? When you look at like the telecom industry, which at this point is now the radio industry, right? Because they've bought up all of the radio stations, like so many of the radio stations. So, you know, you're fighting against corporate giants and, you know, Google and Apple and these companies that are just massive. And you don't have, you know, we don't necessarily have any kind of say in those issues. Now, that said, I think your question is really interesting because I think what we have been seeing just in the last few years is a real interest in community and college radio. Like, people are getting, I think, really excited. Certainly in Portland alone, we've now got, you know, we had one community radio station for like 40 years. And now I think we've got four. Yeah. So it's, and you know, the FCC opened up a whole new bunch of bandwidth, a whole new bunch of, ringing phone, let me turn that off, new community wavelengths, right, that gave out more licensing. I think that was in 2007 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been this sort of like resurgence in interest in community radio, and I think the people who do community radio are saying that they are finding that there's this huge hunger for that.
Yeah.
Because people do want to be able to listen to the radio and discover a new band and then go get it in their record shop. You know, that's something that has a lot of resonance for people, and it's a great way to do it, especially when, like, on a community radio station like here in Portland, X-Ray FM, let's say, the DJ is your friend, right? The DJ is somebody you know, and they're playing this awesome band, and you go, oh my God, I love that band. And then you go to Mississippi Records or Jackpot or Music Millennium, and you buy the record. Like, it's a very organic, community-focused way to do music that's, like, also a throwback to, you know, my childhood.
Yeah.
But in other words, I think my answer to that question is I think we have to do it for ourselves. I do not think we can hope that the corporations will ever come around to do that for us. I don't think they have our interests at heart. I think they're making money and they're pleasing their boards of directors. They got nothing, or boards of shareholders. They're not doing anything for us.
Yeah.
So I think we have to do that stuff for ourselves.
Yeah, because it seems like one of the sort of fundamental problems with the internet is that it sort of gives artists the ability to give their music away for free, and they all do. And then it seems like artists feel like they have to do it because everybody's doing it. And then nobody buys music anymore, and people wonder why people Like, it's just there's no incentive to buy music, but it seems like these gatekeepers, these companies like Spotify, like YouTube, could set it up however they wanted. And maybe, like you said, it works for them. They're making enough of a profit that they don't really care. But it just seems like if you created the necessity, like if people could only stream one song from the album or two songs, and then they had to buy it, it seems like they would. But then again, what do I know? I just run a small little podcast and a website. But thoughts to ponder. I wanted to, before I let you go, Portia, I wanted to ask you one more question. And I sort of failed to mention some of the artists that you work with. I'll put all that information on my website. But you have a lot of artists, but a few that I'm familiar with are the Decemberists, Deerhoof, and the late Elliot Smith. And I wanted to ask you about Elliot Smith. Was he signed to Kill Rock Stars from the beginning of his career? When did he come on board?
Yeah, pretty much. He had one record that was out on a small Portland label called Cavity Search before he signed to Kill Rock Stars. And then he signed to Kill Rock Stars in 1994, and he did the self-titled Elliot Smith album and his best-selling album, Either Or,
yeah,
with Kill Rock Stars.
Great album.
Yeah, amazing album. And then he ended up moving on to DreamWorks for two records.
Okay.
Unfortunately, then he passed away.
Yeah.
So we didn't get any, you know, to hear where he could have gone, which is tragic. But yeah, he was sort of the big '90s artist. I mean, one of the big '90s artists for Kill Rock Stars. Kill Rock Stars was lucky to have several really amazing artists in the '90s, like Slater Kinney and Bikini Kill.
Yeah.
Lound.
Excellent. And how many artists do you have signed to KRS currently?
You know, I don't really know how to answer that question because I can only say like there's active roster and then there's just, you know, I mean, we have 600 records, so
yeah,
a lot of that is catalog. A lot of that is stuff that's 25 years old. But I would say our active roster is like maybe 30 artists.
Okay.
Pardon me.
Cool. Well, listen, Portia, I'm going to let you go. I know we talked about doing like 30 minutes and we're almost at 45. So I'm going to let you get back to your work day, but I wanted to thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. And the website, your website is killrockstars.com. And I have to ask you one more question. I ask everybody, can people send you music? Do you accept unsolicited submissions? How do you deal with that?
I do. I prefer that people send me a link to like a SoundCloud stream so that I can listen to it. You know, don't send me something I have to get out of a Dropbox folder because I'm not going to do it.
You're not going to download
it. Or a WAV file or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do listen to demos. I always like to know what's out there. I would say the funny part is that I'd say like 99% of people who send demos aren't actually ready to be on a record label.
Yeah.
I think they're almost always prematurely excited about getting their music to a label. Because one of the things that's true about the industry today is that if you're doing it something really great, someone is going to find you. And you don't have to necessarily go putting yourself, you know, sending emails to people because people will find you. I mean, that's the best part, right? Word of mouth and word travels fast. And if you've got your stuff up on Bandcamp and you start playing shows and you're like blowing everybody away, people are going to be telling their friends and they're going to be like, oh my God, you guys see this band. And, you know, and sooner or later, some labels are going to start hearing about it because... And also, you know, the other thing that artists can really do to help themselves is become part of a community, become part of a musical community. You know, it's like make friends with the people in your practice space, go see them play, have them come see you play, have a community, because that's really how these things happen. You know, most of the bands that get signed to Kill Rock Stars, we are told about them by our other bands. You know, they're like, oh, my God, we played with this incredible band in Cleveland or something.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, and we go check them out, you know. It's really a lot of word of mouth. And so cold emails are almost like, I would almost say don't bother. Don't waste your time.
Like it's probably not going to be worth your time. Do you ever discover artists that way? I mean, Does it happen at all?
I think we signed 4 artists from demos, from okay. unsolicited demos. One of them was the amazing Marnie Stern, if you're familiar with her, the guitar shredder. She's amazing. And she, you know, she was someone who worked a day job and lived in New York City and was in her early 30s and really didn't know anything about the music business. She was like this sort of guitar savant.
Yeah.
And that's very rare. Like that was, you know, she didn't have the option to become part of a musical community because she just wasn't, you know, she wasn't going out. She was staying in her room playing incredible guitar, you know, teaching herself and learning how to play incredible guitar. So that was a very rare kind of find. You know, not, that's almost never the case.
So 4 over the course of 26 years or 4 since you've been there? Yeah. So that kind of puts things in perspective. Well, cool. Totally. Maybe someone out there listening to this will be the 5th artist to get signed to Kill Rock Stars from a cold email. maybe, perhaps not. But Portia, thanks again. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Aaron.
Have a great day.
You too. Take care.